Obviously, a great deal of attention was paid to Angelina Jolie when she had her mastectomy as a way of prevention after seeing that she had the gene that indicated she was at higher risk for breast cancer. Did the publicity surrounding that, in your view, put a healthy focus on prevention, or did it fuel a debate over a very controversial means of addressing the problem? And, you know, what do you think about every woman running out and getting tested for genetic predisposition?
Well, I think the way she handled it was just about right. What she said in the New York Times, the way she rolled it out, I think it is a net positive. We do need to put out cautionary notes, however, and that is to say we're talking here about risk reductions. And in her case, she went through a process of determining how important it was to not have surgery versus to be safe, her own mother having died of breast cancer. And
her aunt just passed away, apparently.
Exactly, and absolutely. Her aunt just – so I think she handled it well. I think the message we need to get out, however, is that in most cases – the preventive actions people can take to reduce their risk are not so disturbing as what she had to do. So if people use sense in the sun, if people simply start exercising, exercise may be the only true wonder drug out there, you can reduce your risk of dying prematurely of cancer. So we're asking people with the beginning of the second century and the century we hope to eliminate cancer is to do one of three things. And one of those is to change your own lifestyle to reduce your own risk. Another is to make a donation to the American Cancer Society. And a third is to participate in our Cancer Prevention Study 3, where we're following 300,000 people throughout their life so we can find other ways to prevent cancer.
Her treatment, again, brings up the issue of affordability. Being Angelina Jolie, she could afford to do what she felt was right for her. What about somebody who isn't Angelina Jolie and doesn't have that kind of money?
Well, that is a problem. And the good news is that we're definitely moving in a direction where people will be able to get the kind of care and treatment that they need. Having said that, we are starting from behind the starting line. We're starting way back in terms of many people simply not having access. So the truth is most of the suffering and most of the death from cancer is needless based on what we know to do. So what we want to do, what the American Cancer Society is trying to do, is make sure everybody can benefit from the successes we've seen. Many of those successes have been based on research funded by public money.
By public money meaning government money or donations from the public?
It's really both, but the lion's share of the funds are government money. And so people like for the Congress to fund the National Institutes of Health, the National Cancer Institute, and we're getting some wonderful results from that in terms of finding answers to very complex questions. And the key is for us to get those answers and solutions to the bedside and to the clinic where it can actually make a difference in whether a person lives or dies.
Of course, you know the political debate, not only about whether government should fund everything it does, but whether government funding is the most efficient way to make it happen. You're saying, I think, that you believe it is.
I think that there's no question but what our nation has essentially the premier biomedical research center in the world. There are other very good ones, but none as of the size and stature of it. But it is important for the private sector to be engaged. The American Cancer Society is so proud because we made a major commitment to cancer research in 1946. And as a result of that, we have now funded some 46 beginning cancer investigators that went on to win the Nobel Prize. No one else has ever done that. And it's so important because right now the government pay line, they call it, is so low that many young investigators simply can't get a grant unless they can get it from the American Cancer Society. So we have targeted beginning investigators, and it's paying off.
On the issue of what you might call preventive mastectomies, which is what Angelina Jolie had and what many other women have had, mm-hmm. Does the Cancer Society have a position on that?
Our position is that simply that each person needs to determine if they want to be screened or evaluated as to whether they have the risk factor, the BRCA1 or 2 gene. Then, if they decide they want to do that, they need to be informed of the risks and benefits of taking any further action. So our approach for many of these things where there isn't a clear, oh, yes, you must, oh, no, don't you dare, but there's not a clear answer, we say that we advise to take the time to work through it and determine what's best for you, because obviously one size doesn't fit all, and some people would choose to take the risk and others would choose not to. So we are proud to be the only voluntary health organization that has a 24/7 call center. You can call free of charge night or day and talk to trained people with the latest data right in front of them on a computer screen and explain the risks and risks and benefits of various decisions one has to make.
But before a woman makes the decision on the mastectomy, very often she has to decide, okay, I have somebody in my family who had breast cancer. Do I even want to know whether I have that genetic predisposition? Do you have a position on that? If one has a history of breast cancer, for instance, should a woman go ahead and be screened for it?
Well, again, we say each person needs to read about and become informed. I remember Mary Claire King, who was the wonderful woman scientist that we funded who mapped the BRCA1 gene, and she was advising people, and she had sisters, and one decided to have the prophylactic mastectomy, the other didn't, and of course you can know where I'm going. The wrong one made the wrong decision. So I think the key point is to get informed. And today, with the access to the American Cancer Society, we are only interested in the cancer patient or the potential cancer patient. You can get a lot of good information, and then you have to make your own choice.
On prostate cancer, there's even perhaps more uncertainty about that than there is about the screening for breast cancer. Men of a certain age, and I'm one of them, probably are very confused about what to do about having a PSA test or not. You have said we're not at a point that the benefits outweigh whatever possible downsides there are, but does that mean no one should get a PSA test if they're 50 or over?
No, and we do have very specific guidelines in that regard. We believe that each man should be informed that there is a test and informed as to what those risks and possible benefits are. A key point here is that there's been a dramatic drop in prostate cancer mortality, and that's a good thing.
And was the PSA test in part responsible for that?
There's no question in my mind but what the PSA test was partly responsible for that decline. However, prostate cancer may be the most overtreated form of cancer out there. So it's not an all good news story, to be honest about it, and it'll be a few years before we're going to be able to determine that particular cancer is aggressive and needs to be treated. That particular one isn't, and you needn't bother with it because then you don't have to worry about some of the side effects of therapy.
How frustrating is it that we don't have really reliable information about a test for a cancer about which we see a big publicity push? For instance, Major League Baseball, you know, keep dad in the game, all of that. Rush out and do what you can to prevent it. Oh, wait a minute, this test might not be reliable and might not be worth the risk.
Well, for most of my career in life and most of the time for the American Cancer, we were running into the woods, and now we're running out of the woods. The problem with that, of course, is we don't have all the answers, and we can't be as precise as we'd like to be. The truth is that there's very few therapies that don't have some downsides to them, some risks. And so I think it will be a while before we're going to be able to say, although I think it's inevitable if we continue to do research, we'll be able to say, be more precise in who needs to be treated or even who needs to be screened. So we need research, as was pointed out during our celebration birthday when we had a panel on research and cancer. We need more, better research on screening and what screening really works and what screening it doesn't work. But the good news is we do have techniques to pick up cancer earlier, and my own wife is a survivor because of that fact. And so I think we just need to be understanding that we have to be a bit patient before we can say we're 100% right all the time.
This is certainly not one you have to answer, but does the CEO of the American Cancer Society get a PSA test?
I have gotten a PSA test during my annual physical every year so far, and my physician and I kid each other and laugh and joke and as to when am I going to stop getting it. And I'm probably getting about to the age when I'll stop getting it because we know the natural history of the disease is such that it's typically slow growing. And thankfully, I've never had a problem. But there's no question but what more men need to spend some time deciding whether they need to have the test or not. Some of my colleagues, both of whom are scientists and physicians, one has a test every year and the other one refuses to have a test.
There's been so much in the last couple of decades about alternative therapies, natural therapies, non-pharmaceutical therapies. We are learning more about what works and what doesn't. But how does that integrate with the work of the Cancer Society?
Well, we believe that alternative therapies, or what we sometimes refer to as integrative therapies, are very important, particularly with respect to the quality of life of people going through the cancer experience. The key point, however, is to be careful not to avoid getting mainline therapy. In other words, that what is often referred to as standard course of care, because that's been proven to work. Or put it differently, that's the gold bar, the gold standard. And so one shouldn't eschew the standard therapy, but clearly there are cases when, in addition to the standard therapy, there are other therapies that can improve the quality of life, and we certainly support people doing that.
And cancer treatment has become very big business, as you know. Mm-hmm. There are more for-profit treatment centers. Just one is Cancer Treatment Centers of America, which, in full disclosure, is an underwriter of Public Broadcasting. But this whole area in general, these for-profit centers, does the Cancer Society feel that they are any more or less effective than the standard treatment at, say, a university hospital?
Well, we're evidence-based, and so what we believe is that any institution should provide to the public in a transparent way what their results are. And obviously, in terms of survival, those data speak for themselves. So we think whether it's a not-for-profit hospital or a for-profit hospital, each should be willing to share what they're doing, how that complies with standard care, and what the results of their therapy happen to be.
You mentioned government funding a while back. Here in Georgia, just to take one example, and Georgia's hardly alone in this, Georgia, one of many states that got settlement with the tobacco companies. The money comes in, but it doesn't go to prevention programs. It goes to the general fund. Mm-hmm. Have you talked to officials here in Georgia and in other states about that? And does it bother you that the money that has at least a stated purpose of saying we want to prevent cancer ends up going to shrink budget shortfalls in states like Georgia?
No, I think monies like tobacco settlement monies need to be spent on prevention and solving the problem that tobacco creates. And it's a miscarriage of stewardship and good policy when something else happens to it. The wonderful part is the progress we've made. We know that tobacco education efforts work today. We know ways in which we can reduce prevalence, especially in children. And so for the money not to be spent in the way that it should be is just a miscarriage of stewardship and good public policy. It's a very key point. We have the Prevention Fund and the Affordable Care Act. For the first time in the history of the nation, you had actual resource being placed in it, and we know if they are spent in the way that is intended, we will get results and become over time the healthiest nation in the world. If they're not, then a whole other scenario plays itself out. One thing that's so important is that there are so few things in life we know for sure. But one of the things we know for sure, that there will be a tsunami of cancer and non-communicable diseases over the next 20 years if we don't intervene. And it's not maybe. Aging is a global phenomenon, and so we know we'll be seeing these diseases, and we know things we can do to intervene now to reduce. So that's why it's important for the World Health Organization to follow up on the UN high-level meeting to set 25 by 25, to set the goal, which is now official, to reduce cancer and non-communicable diseases by 25% by the year 2025.
Have you spoken to officials in Georgia about the tobacco settlement issue?
Yes, we have, and we will continue to do that, because it's a huge opportunity, not just in Georgia, but in every state, to reduce the amount of tobacco prevalence, and we can measure the results from that in a timely fashion, and it's particularly important to protect children. The tobacco industry is really an abuser of children, and they're marketing their products, causes many of them to get addicted, and the earlier they get addicted, the more likely they are to be a lifetime smoker and be killed by the product.
A lot of nonprofits have faced increased scrutiny over the years in terms of salaries, where the money goes, and that sort of thing. Charity Watch, I think, placed you a couple of years ago as number two in compensation. Is that something you feel that you have to explain to people, the money that you make and that other top executives in the Cancer Society make?
Yes, I think so. We have a compensation committee, and it's chaired by our chairman of the board. They select an external consulting group that gives them the market values and so forth. And our head of public relations handles inquiries about that. So we're very transparent about it and should be. And most of our brother and sister organizations are as well. But it is a kind of a topic of interest to people. And we're proud that we have a process that literally has meetings going year-round basis, meeting half a dozen times a year to determine what the proper salaries are for all of our executives, not just the CEO, but all of our top executives.
How would you say to people, okay, we are worth this money?
Well, we are worth this much money because there are probably 880 not-for-profits that say their reason to exist is to fight cancer. There's only one that's in virtually every community, 5,300 communities. There's only one that offers around-the-clock free call services. There's only one that is funding over $100 million in research funding beginning investigators. There's only one that can provide the kind of navigation services we can for people to get through the healthcare system. So we think it's a good buy. We think, and the American public, apparently, Senator Grassley said to me one time, I'm not worried about organizations like yours because if people don't like what you're doing, they can just stop giving to you. We don't happen to have big endowments. We don't take a lot of public money, but we do take very seriously the donations that people give us, and we try to turn that around and deliver on our mission. And we do that in a very timely fashion and one that we know relates to reduced suffering and saving of a lot of lives.
You've also said your mission was to put yourself out of business. Will you be out of business 100 years from now?
I think so. When the American Cancer Society was founded 100 years ago, any serious diagnosis was a virtual death sentence, only to be preceded by a protracted period of pain and suffering. We don't have all the answers, but today cancer is potentially the most preventable and the most curable of the major life-threatening diseases facing Americans and people around the world. So our job is to turn that potentiality into a reality for all people as soon as possible, and that's why we think we can finish the fight in this century. And our slogan now is, let's finish the fight. And I think about the fact that we know that human cancer has been around for thousands of years and is rapidly becoming the number one cause of death in the world if we don't intervene. But we have the knowledge and information to finish the fight. And so we don't have all the answers, of course, but we have so many answers that aren't being applied, and we're bound to get more answers if we continue to fund research. So I am actually optimistic that this will be cancer's last century and therefore the last century for the American Cancer Society.
In the next 100 years, what would you say would be the Cancer Society's role and the role of other nonprofits in trying to address all of this at a time when we are seeing obviously huge advertising and pushes from industry folks to be the forefront and make even patients sometimes, if you will, salesmen for the companies?
You know, it's such an interesting time because the necessity for not-for-profit organizations has never been greater in our country. And, of course, we're proud. We think we have the best ones in the world. But regardless, I think key to solving the cancer problem, and by the way, many other social issues and health problems, is having that independent sector, that not-for-profit sector there, because there are some things that need to be done that there's no profit in it. And there are things that need to be done that the government's never going to pay for. So the fact that here, right here in Atlanta, you can go to the American Cancer Society Hope Lodge, and we saved patients being treated in Atlanta last year some $2.2 million in housing costs. But more important than that, they got to be with people who could be supportive of them. So I think the key point is that part of what makes America so great is that we have a not-for-profit sector. We can say, our only interest is what's in the best interest of the person facing cancer or his or her caregiver and family, and we can also advocate. And so we can speak out, and we aren't in any way compromised in our ability to say, here's the evidence as we see it, here's the truth as we know it, and someone can. Well, you're saying that just because you make profits. Well, we don't make profits. So I think I guess what I would want to say is that I believe we will finish the fight this century, but I don't believe we can finish the fight without a strong not-for-profit sector with organizations like the American Cancer Society.
Dr. John Ceferin is the CEO of the American Cancer Society, which celebrated its 100th birthday this month. Dr. Ceferin, thank you so much for giving us this time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.